program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Hello and welcome to Audio Journal's look at history from all points of the globe, a program that reports on what has happened so we might consequently find out what could happen. I'm Shruti, and for the next hour we'll explore various topics on the history of factories in America. The first article is Radium Girls, the women who fought for their lives in a killer workplace. Being poisoned by their employer led these women to fight back. This is written by Dawn Vaughn from Britannica.com. At the onset of World War I, several factories were established across the United States to produce watches and military dials painted with a material containing radium, a radioactive element that glows in the dark. Hundreds of young women were hired for the well-paying painting jobs because their small hands were well-suited for the exacting, detailed work. Radium had been discovered just 20 years ago by French physicists Marie Curie and Pierre Curie, and its properties were not well known. Because it had been used successfully in the treatment of cancer, many considered radium a miracle element, and a variety of commercial products were manufactured in which radium was an ingredient, including toothpaste and cosmetics. The women hired to paint dials came to be known as ghost girls because the radium dust to which they were exposed daily made their clothes, hair, and skin literally glow. Many of the women wore their best dress on the job so the fabric would shine brightly when they went dancing after work. Some even applied the paint to their teeth because it gave them radiant smiles. What's more, the painters ingested the radioactive substances as part of their job. Because some of the watch dials on which they worked were extremely small, they were instructed to use their lips to bring their paintbrushes to a fine point. When they asked about radium safety, they were assured by their managers they had nothing to worry about. Of course, that wasn't true. Radium can be extremely dangerous, especially with repeated exposure. Marie Curie suffered radiation burns while handling it, and she eventually died from radiation exposure. Other researchers also perished. It wasn't long before the radium girls began to experience the physical ravages of this exposure. Among the first was Amelia Molly Maggia, who painted watches for the Radium Luminous Material Corp. Later, the United States Radium Corp. in Orange, New Jersey. Maggia's first symptom was a toothache, which required the removal of a tooth. Soon, the tooth next to it had to be extracted. Painful ulcers, bleeding, and full of pus developed where the teeth had been. The mysterious malady spread through Maggia's mouth and lower jaw, which had to be removed, then into other parts of her body. Maggia died on September 12, 1922, from massive hemorrhage. Doctors were puzzled as to the cause of her condition, and oddly, they determined that she had died of syphilis. In growing numbers, other radium girls became deathly ill, experiencing many of the same agonizing symptoms as Maggia. For 2 years, their employer vociferously denied any connection between the girls' deaths and their work. Facing a downturn in business because of the growing controversy, the company finally commissioned an independent study of the matter, which concluded that the painters had died from the effects of radium exposure. Refusing to accept the report's findings, the company commissioned additional studies that came to the opposite conclusion and decried the girls who had taken ill. The public continued to assume that radium was safe. In 1925, a pathologist named Harrison Martland developed a test that proved conclusively that radium had poisoned the watch painters by destroying their bodies from the inside. The radium industry tried to discredit Martland's findings, but the radium girls themselves fought back. Many knew that their days were numbered, but they wanted to do something to help their colleagues still working with the deadly substance. In 1927, attorney Raymond Berry agreed to accept their case. Many of the watch painters had just months to live and were forced to accept an out-of-court settlement. Still, their experiences made the issue of radium safety a front-page story across the world. But even then, the United States Radium Corp denied its role, and women continued to get sick and die. It wasn't until 1938 when a dying radium worker named Catherine Wolfe Donahue successfully sued the Radium Doll Co. over her illness that the issue was finally settled. The legacy of the Radium Girls can't be understated. Their case was among the first in which a company was held responsible for the health and safety of its employees, and it led to a variety of reforms, as well as the creation of the U.S. Occupational Safety and Health Administration. The next article is called "Where Did the Phrase Mad as a Hatter Come From?" by Elizabeth Nix from thehistory.com. Lewis Carroll's 1865 novel, Alice's Adventure in Wonderland, famously features an eccentric character called the Hatter, who's referred to in the story as Mad and became popularly known as the Mad Hatter. However, the phrase "mad as a hatter" used to describe someone who's crazy or prone to unpredictable behavior didn't originate with Carroll. Instead, the expression is linked to the hat-making industry and mercury poisoning. In the 18th and 19th centuries, industrial workers used a toxic substance, mercury nitrate, as part of the process of turning the fur of small animals such as rabbits into felt for hats. Workplace safety standards were often lax, and prolonged exposure to mercury caused employees to develop a variety of physical and mental ailments, including tremors, dubbed hatter shakes, speech problems, emotional instability, and hallucinations. In Connecticut, mercury-induced tremors were called the Danbury shakes, after the city of Danbury, which was the leading center for hat-making during the 19th century and into the early years of the 20th century. By the 1920s, only a handful of headwear manufacturers remained the place once billed as the hat capital of the world. In the U.S., the use of mercury in the production of felt finally was banned in the early 1940s. Researchers have suggested that Boston Corbeil hat industry worker who killed John Wilkes Booth, President Abraham Lincoln's assassin, might have suffered from poor mental health due to mercury poisoning. Corbeil, who had been employed as a hat maker since he was a young man, became a religious zealot and in 1858 castrated himself with a pair of scissors as a way to curb his libido. He went on to serve in the Union Army during the Civil War, and after Lincoln was shot by Booth on April 14, 1865, at Ford Theater in Washington, D.C., Corbeil and his regiment, the 16th New York Cavalry, were sent down to track down the gunman who was on the run. On April 26, the soldiers surrounded Booth in a Virginia barn. However, Corbeil disobeyed orders to capture the fugitive alive and instead shot and killed him. Corbeil was cleared of blame by the military and lauded by many in the public as a hero for his role in avenging the president's death. Eventually, he resumed working in the hat industry in the Northeast before moving to Kansas in 1878, where he lived a solitary existence as a homesteader. In 1887, he landed in a mental asylum after threatening a group of people at the Kansas State House with a gun. The following year, this possible Mad Hatter, who was then in his 50s, escaped the facility and soon disappeared for good. Next, we have Discovering a Hidden Epidemic of Severe Black Lung Disease by Priyanka Bhagani from PBS.com. By the 1990s, cases of black lung, an incurable respiratory disease that afflicts coal miners, had hit historic lows, and its most severe form was thought to be nearly eradicated. According to the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, but a new Frontline NPR joint investigation, Coal's Deadly Dust, reveals how thousands of coal miners now face an epidemic of the most severe and deadly form of black lung known as progressive massive fibrosis, or PMF. NPR correspondent Howard Burks was reporting on the resurgence of black lung when he received a tip 2 years ago about an outbreak of severe black lung, the disease that epidemiologists thought was nearly gone. He left Brandon Crum, a radiologist in Kentucky whose clinic was overwhelmed with such cases. In this scene from Cole's Deadly Dust, Crum displays x-rays of multiple minors with PMF. The biggest concern at the time for me was seeing young men my age, and I'm 43 or younger than I am, with the most severe form of the disease, he told Burks. Crum said he took his concerns to NIOSH, a federal agency that tests workers working minors for disease and tracks the occurrence of black lung. Scott Laney, an epidemiologist at NIOSH, said he didn't believe Crum's findings at first. His agency hadn't detected the sharp increase in PMF in its testing of minors. But then, Lancey told Crum's clinic and looked at the x-rays. His reaction, he told Burks, was horror, shock. I was really taken aback, not only that these cases were legitimate, but just how severe they were. Lancey said it indicated that he had a huge problem, and we realized immediately that it wasn't going to be isolated to a single clinic. In Cole's Deadly Dust, Frontline NPR reveals just how large the epidemic has become. Over 5 years, researchers of NIOSH have reported 99 cases of severe black lung across the country. But NPR Frontline have now identified more than 2,000 cases in just 5 Appalachian states over the same time frame. The film investigates how the coal mining industry and government regulators failed to protect miners from this devastating epidemic. Next, I'll read about the Mill Girls of Lowell. Introduction. Who are the Mill Girls? The term Mill Girls was occasionally used in antebellum newspapers and periodicals to describe the young Yankee woman, generally 15 to 30 years old, who worked in the large cotton factories. They were also called female operatives. Female textile workers often described themselves as mill girls. While affirming the virtue of their class and the dignity of their labor, during early labor protests, they asserted that they were the daughters of freemen whose rights could not be trampled upon with impunity. Despite the hardship of mill work, women remained an important part of the textile workforce for many years. In the late 19th century, women held nearly two-thirds of all textile jobs in Lowell, with many immigrant women joining Yankee mill girls in the textile industry. To find workers for their mills in early Lowell, the textile corporations recruited women from New England farms and villages. These daughters of Yankee farmers had few economic opportunities, and many were enticed by the prospect of monthly cash wages and room and board in a comfortable boarding house. Beginning in 1823, with the opening of Lowell's first factory, large numbers of young women moved to the growing city. In the mills, female workers faced long hours of toil and after grueling working conditions. Yet, many female textile workers saved money and gained a measure of economic independence. In addition, the city's shops and religious institution, along with its educational and recreational activities, offered an exciting social life that most women from small villages had never experienced. Most of the women who came to Lowell were from farms and small villages. Some had labored in small textile mills, others had produced cotton or woolen goods or shoes for merchants who employed men and women in their homes and paid them by the pieces they produced. On many farms, the father was a property owner and head of household. Family members shared daily and seasonal tasks. In addition to strenuous chores outdoors, mothers and daughters toiled in the home, cooking, cleaning, and making clothes. The hard scrabble life proved increasingly difficult for young women, and by the early 1800s, a growing number of Yankee farm families faced severe economic difficulties. For many young, rural women, the decision to leave home for a city like Lowell was often born of necessity. For most young women, Lowell's social and economic opportunities existed within the limits imposed by the powerful textile corporations. most pronounced was the control corporations exerted over the lives of their workers. The men who ran the corporations and managed the mills sought to regulate the moral conduct and social behavior of their workplace. Within the factory, overseers were responsible for maintaining work discipline and meeting production schedules in the boarding house. The keepers enforced curfews and strict codes of conduct. Male and female workers were expected to observe the Sabbath, and temperature was strongly encouraged. The clanging factory bell summoned operatives to and from the mill, constantly reminding them that their days were structured around work. Most textile workers toiled for 12 to 14 hours a day and half a day on Saturdays. The mills were closed on Sundays. Typically, mill girls were employed for 9 to 10 months of the year, and many left the factories during part of the summer to visit back home. Living in a boarding house. The majority of mill girls in Lowell lived in boarding houses. These large, corporation-owned buildings were often run by a female keeper and a husband and wife. A typical boarding house consisted of 8 units with 20 to 40 women living in each unit. For most young women, living in the boarding house was dramatically different from life on the farm. Usually, they shared a room with 3 other women, sleeping 2 to a bed. A fireplace in each room provided warmth in the colder seasons. The keeper prepared 3 meals a day, and the women dined together in a common room. Women formed many new friendships with other female boarders. The bonds created through daily social intercourse helped new workers adjust to the demands of factory life. And during the strife of labor protests, boarding houses often became informal centers of organizing activity. Voices of protest. Lowell's textile corporations paid higher wages than those in the other textile cities, but work was arduous and conditions were frequently unhealthy. Although the city's corporations threatened labor reformers with firing or blacklisting, many mill girls protested wage cuts and working conditions. Female workers struck twice in the 1830s and in the 1840s. Female labor reformers banded together to promote the 10-hour day. In the face of strong corporate opposition, few strikes succeeded, however, and Lowell's workforce remained largely unorganized. Adding to the difficulties of organizing Lowell's operatives was the changing ethnic composition of the workforce. The number of Irish employed in Lowell's mills rose dramatically in the 1840s as Irish men and women fled their famine-stricken land. Thousands of immigrants from many other countries settled in Lowell in the decades after the Civil War, yet women remained a major part of the Lowell's textile workplace. Enlarged strikes against the textile manufacturers in 1903 and 1912, women workers played prominent roles. One of Lowell's early leading labor reformers was a mill girl named Sarah Bagley. Born on a New Hampshire farm in 1806, Bagley arrived in Lowell in 1836 and worked in a number of mills. She became a powerful speaker on behalf of male and female workers, promoted the 10-hour workday, and edited the labor newspaper, The Voice of the Industry. In a letter to a friend in 1846, Bagley promoted the labor reform publication Factory Tracts as representing the interests of those who are not willing to see our sex made into living machines to do the bidding of the incorporated aristocrats and reduced to a sum for their bodily services hardly sufficient to keep soul and body together. Although the struggles of Bagley and other mill girls to achieve legislation for a 10-hour day failed, Lowell's textile corporations did reduce the workday to 11 hours. Next, look into history about the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory Fire from history.com. On March 25, 1911, the Triangle Shirtwaist Company factory in New York City burned, killing 146 workers. It is remembered as one of the most infamous incidents in American industrial history, as the deaths were largely preventable. Most of the victims died as a result of neglected safety features and locked doors within the factory building. The tragedy brought widespread attention to dangerous sweatshop conditions of factories and led to development of a series of laws and regulations that better protected the safety of workers. The Triangle factory owned by Max Blank and Isaac Harris was located in the top 3 floors of the Ash Building on the corner of Green Street and Washington Place in Manhattan. It was a true sweatshop, employing young immigrant women who worked in a cramped space at lines of sewing machines. Nearly all the workers were teenage girls who did not speak English and worked 14 hours a day, Monday through Friday, and 8 hours a day on the weekends. In 1911, there were 4 elevators with access to the factory floors, but only 2 were fully operational, and the workers had to file down a narrow corridor in order to reach it. There were 2 stairways down to the street, but one was locked from the outside to prevent stealing, and the other only opened inward. The fire escape was so narrow that it could have taken hours for all the workers to use it. Even in the best circumstances, and in fact, it collapsed during the fire under the strain of extreme heat and weight as people were rushing to get down. The danger of fire in factories like the Triangle Shirtwaist was well known, but high levels of corruption in both the government industry and city government generally ensured that there is no useful precautions were taken to prevent fires. Blank and Harris already had a suspicious history of factory fires. The Triangle Factory was twice scorched in 1902, while their Diamond Waste Company factory burned twice in 1907 and in 1910. It seems that Blank and Harris deliberately torched their workplace before business hours in order to collect on the large fire insurance policies they purchased, a not uncommon practice in the early 20th century. While this was not the cause of the 1911 fire, it contributed to the tragedy as Blank and Harris refused to install sprinkler systems and take other safety measures in case they needed to burn down their shops again. Added to the delinquency were Blank and Harris's notorious anti-worker policies. Their employers were paid a mere $9 to $15 a week, despite working 12 hours a day every day. When the International Ladies' Garment Workers Union led a strike in 1909, demanding higher pay and shorter and more predictable hours, Blank and Harris Company was one of the few manufacturers who resisted hiring police as thugs to imprison the striking woman and paying off politicians to look the other way. What started the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire? On March 25th, a Saturday afternoon, there were 600 workers at the factory when a fire began in a rag bin. The member attempted to use the fire hose to extinguish it, but it was unsuccessful as the hose was routed and its valve was rusted shut. As the fire grew, panic ensued. The young workers tried to exit the building by the elevator, but it was designed to hold only 20 people. The operator was able to make just 4 trips back and forth before it broke down amid the heat and flames. In a desperate attempt to escape the fire, the girls left behind waiting for the elevator plunged down the shaft to their deaths. The girls who tried to flee via the stairwells also met awful demises. When they found locked doors at some of the exits, many suffocated from the smoke or were burned alive. Those workers, including the owners who were on the 12th floor, 2 floors above the fire, escaped to the roof and then to adjoining buildings. As firefighters arrived, they witnessed a horrible scene. The girls who did not make it to the stairwells or the elevator were trapped by the fire inside the factory and began to jump from the windows to escape it. The bodies of the jumpers fell on the fire hoses, making it difficult to begin fighting the fire. Also, the firefighters' ladders reached just below the 7th floor, and the fire was on the 8th floor. In one case, a life net was unfurled to catch jumpers, but 3 girls jumped at the same time, ripping the net. The net turns out to be most ineffectual. Within 18 minutes, it was all over. A total of 146 people were killed by the fire due to severe burns, smoke inhalation, falls from great heights, and injuries sustained during the incident. The fire helped unite organized labor and reform-minded politicians like progressive New York Governor Alfred E. Smith and Senator Robert F. Wagner, one of the legislative architects of President Franklin D. Roosevelt's New Deal agenda. Frances Perkins, who served on a committee that helped to set up the factory investigating commission in New York in the wake of the fire, would later become Roosevelt's Secretary of Labor. The workers' union set up a march on April 5th on New York's Fifth Avenue to protest the conditions that led to the fire. It was attended by 80,000 to 120,000 people. Despite a good deal of evidence that the owners and management had been horribly negligent in the fire, a grand jury indicted them on manslaughter charges, but the prosecution failed to convict them. To settle lawsuits against them, the owner of Ash Building eventually paid $75 in compensation to some of the victims' families. Meanwhile, the factory owners, Blankenhanners, were paid $400 per worker's death by their insurer. Still, the massacre for which they're responsible did finally compel the city to enact reform. In addition to the Salvin-Hoey Fire Prevention Law passed that October, the New York Democrats set took up the cause of the worker and became known as a Reform Party. Both were crucial in preventing similar disasters in the future. Child labor. Child labor, from thehistory.com, is the use of children as workers, servants, and apprentices has been practiced throughout most of human history, but reached its zenith during the Industrial Revolution. Miserable working conditions, including crowded and unclean factories, a lack of safety codes, and long hours were the norm. Children could be paid less and were less likely to organize into unions. Working children were typically unable to attend school, creating a cycle of poverty that was difficult to break. 19th century reformers and labor organizers sought to restrict child labor and improve working conditions to uplift the masses. But it took the Great Depression, a time when Americans were desperate of employment, to shake long-held practices of child labor in the United States. The child labor in the United States. The Puritan work ethic of the 13 colonies and their founders valued hard work over idleness, and this ethos applied to children as well. Through the first half of the 1800s, child labor was an essential part of the agricultural and handicraft economy of the United States. Children worked on family farms and as indentured servants for others. To learn a trade, boys often began their apprenticeships between the ages of 10 and 14. The Industrial Revolution saw the rise of factories and mines in need of workers. Children were ideal employees because they could be paid less, were often of smaller size, so could attend to tasks in tight spaces, and were less likely to organize and strike against their pitiable working conditions. Before the Civil War, the women and children played a critical role in American manufacturing, though it was still a relatively small part of the economy. Advances in manufacturing techniques after the war increased the number of jobs and therefore increased the number of child laborers. Immigration of child labor. Immigration to the United States coincidentally peaked during the Industrial Revolution and led to a new source of labor and child labor. When the Irish potato famine struck in the 1840s, Irish immigrants moved to fill lower-level factory jobs. In the 1880s, groups from Southern and Eastern Europe arrived, provided a new pool of child workers. The trend continues today as many immigrant children work in agriculture, which is exempt from certain labor laws. National Child Labor Committee. Educational reformers of the mid-19th century attempted to convince the public that a primary school education was a necessity if the nation were to advance as a whole. Several states established a minimum wage for labor and requirements for school attendance, though many of these laws were full of loopholes and were readily exploited by employees hungry for cheap labor. Beginning in the 1900s, efforts to regulate or eliminate child labor became central to social reform in the United States. The National Child Labor Committee, organized in 1904, and state child labor committees led the charge. These organizations employed flexible methods in the face of slow progress. They pioneered tactics like investigations, like experts, the use of photography of child laborers to spark outrage at the poor conditions of children at work, and pervasive lobbying efforts. They used written pamphlets, leaflets, and mass mailings to reach the public. From 1902 to 1915, child labor committees emphasized reform through state legislators. Many laws restricting child labor were passed as part of the Progressive Era reform movement, but many southern states resisted, leading to the decision to work for a federal child labor law. While Congress passed laws in 1916 and 1918, the Supreme Court declared them unconstitutional. The supporters of child labor law saw a constitutional amendment authorizing federal child labor legislation, and it passed in 1924. Though states were not keen to ratify it, the conservative political climate of the 1920s, together with opposition from farm and church organizations fearing increased federal power over children, acted as roadblocks. The Great Depression left thousands of Americans without jobs and led to sweeping reforms under the New Deal programs of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. These focused on increasing federal oversight of the workplace and giving out-of-work adult jobs, thereby creating a powerful motive to remove children from the workforce. Almost all of the codes developed under the National Industrial Recovery Act served to reduce child labor. The Fair Labor Standards of 1938 set a national minimum wage for the first time, a maximum number of hours for workers in interstate commerce, and placed limitations on child labor. In effect, the employment of children under 16 years of age was prohibited in manufacturing and mining. Changing attitudes towards work and social reform weren't the only factors reducing child labor. The invention of improved machinery that mechanized many of the repetitive tasks previously given to children led to a decrease of children in the workforce. Semi-skilled adults took their place for more complex tasks. Education underwent reforms too. Many states increasing the number of years of schooling required to hold certain jobs, lengthened the school year, and began to more strictly enforce truancy laws. In 1949, Congress amended the child labor law to include businesses not covered in 1938, like transportation, communications, and public utilities. Although child labor had been significantly stalled in the United States, it lingers in certain areas of the economy, like agriculture, where migrants workers are more difficult to regulate. Since 1938, federal laws have excluded child farm workers from labor protections provided to other working children. For example, children 12 and younger can legally work in farm fields despite the risks posed by exposure to pesticides and farm machinery. Employers in the garment industry have turned to the children of illegal immigrants in an effort to compete with imports from low-wage nations. Despite laws limiting the number of hours for work, children and teens still attending school, the increasing cost of education means many are working longer hours to make ends meet. State-by-state enforcement of child labor laws varies to this day. Industrial Revolution in Modern History, the process of change from an agrarian and handicraft economy to one dominated by industry and machine manufacturing. These technological changes introduced novel ways of working and living and fundamentally transformed society. This process began in Britain in the 18th century and from there spread to other parts of the world. Although used earlier by French writers, the term Industrial Revolution was first popularized by the English economic historian Arnold Toynbee. Britain's economic development from 1760 to 1840. Since Toynbee's time, the term has been more broadly applied as a process of economic transformation more than as a period of time in a particular setting. This explains why some areas, such as China and India, did not begin their first industrial revolutions until the 20th century, while others, such as the United States and Western Europe, began undergoing second industrial revolutions by the late 19th century. Characteristics of the Industrial Revolution. The main features involved in the Industrial Revolution were technological, socioeconomic, and cultural. The technological changes included the following. The use of new basic materials, chiefly iron and steel, the use of the new energy sources, including both fuels and motive power, such as coal and steam engine, electricity, petroleum, and the internal combustion engine, the invention of new machines, such as the spinning jenny, and the power loom that permitted increased production with a smaller expenditure of human energy. A new organization of work known as the factory system, which entailed increased division of labor and specialization of function, important developments in transportation and communication, including the steam locomotive, steamship, automobile, airplane, telegraph, and radio, and the increasing application of science to industry. These technological changes made possible a tremendously increased use of natural resources in the mass production of manufactured goods. There are also many new developments in non-industrial spheres, including the following. Agricultural improvements that made possible the provision for food for a larger non-agricultural population, economic changes that resulted in a wider distribution of wealth, the decline of land as a source of wealth in the face of rising industrial production, and increased international trade. political changes reflecting the shift in economic power, as well as new state policies corresponding to needs of industrialized society. Sweeping social changes, including the growth of cities, the development of working class movements, and the emergence of new patterns of authority and cultural transformations of a broad order. Workers acquired new and distinctive skills, and their relation to their tasks shifted. Instead of being craftsmen working with hand tools, they became machine operators subject to factory discipline. Finally, there was a psychological change. Confidence in the ability to use resources and master nature was heightened. The First Industrial Revolution. In the period 1760 to 1830, the Industrial Revolution was largely confined to Britain. Aware of their head start, the British forbade the export of machinery, skilled workers, and manufacturing technique. Their British monopoly could not last forever, especially since some Britons saw profitable industrial opportunities abroad, while continental European businessmen sought to lure British know-how to their countries. Two Englishmen, William and John Cockerill, brought the Industrial Revolution to Belgium by developing machine shops at Liège, and Belgium became the first country in continental Europe to be transformed economically. Like its British progenitor, the Belgian Industrial Revolution centered in iron, coal, and textiles. France was more slowly and less thoroughly industrialized than either Britain or Belgium. While Britain was establishing its industrial leadership, France was immersed in its revolution. An uncertain political situation discouraged large investments in industrial innovations. By 1848, France had become an industrial power, but despite great growth under the Second Empire, it remained behind Britain. Other European countries lagged far behind. Their bourgeoisie lacked the wealth, power, and opportunities of their British, French, and Belgian counterparts. Politicians' conditions in the other nations also hindered industrial expansion. Germany, for example, despite vast resources of coal and iron, did not begin its industrial expansion until after national unity was achieved in 1870. Once begun, Germany's industrial production grew so rapidly that by the turn of the century, that nation was outproducing Britain to steel and had become the world leader in the chemical industries. The rise of U.S. industrial power in the 19th and 20th centuries also far outstripped European efforts, and Japan too joined the Industrial Revolution with striking success. The Eastern European countries were behind early in the 20th century. It was not until the five-year plans that the Soviet Union became a major industrial power. Telescoping into a few decades, the industrialization that had taken a century and a half in Britain, the mid-20th century witnessed the spread of the Industrial Revolution such as China to other areas such as China and India. The technological and economic aspects of the Industrial Revolution brought about significant sociocultural changes. In its initial changes, it seemed to deepen laborers' poverty and misery. Their employment and subsistence became dependent on costly means of production that few people could afford to own. Job security was lacking, workers were frequently displaced by technological improvements, and a large labor pool, lack of worker protections, and regulations meant long hours for miserable wages, living in unsanitary tenements, exploitation and abuse in the workplace. But even as the problems arose, so too did new ideas that aimed to address them. These ideas were pushed innovations and regulations that provided people with more material conveniences while also enabling them to produce more, travel faster, and communicate more rapidly. The Second Industrial Revolution. Despite considerable overlapping with the old, there was mounting evidence for a new industrial revolution. In the late 19th and 20th centuries, in terms of basic materials, modern industry began to exploit many natural and synthetic resources not hitherto utilized. Lighter metals, rare earths, and new alloys, and synthetic products such as plastics, as well as new energy sources, combined with these were developments in machines, tools, and computers that gave rise to the automatic factory. Although some segments of industry were almost completely mechanized in the early to mid-19th century, automatic operation, as distinct from the assembly line, first achieved major significance in the second half of the 20th century. ownership of the means of production also underwent changes. The oligarchical ownership of the means of production that characterized the Industrial Revolution in the early to mid-19th century gave way to a wider distribution of ownership through purchase of common stocks by individuals and by institutions such as insurance companies in the first half of the 20th century. Many countries of Europe socialized basic sectors of their economies. There was also, during that period, a change in political theories. Instead of the laissez-faire ideas that dominated the economic and social thought of the classical Industrial Revolution, governments generally moved into the social and economic realm to meet the needs of their more complex industrial societies. That trend was reversed in the United States and the United Kingdom beginning in the 1980s. History of technology. The development over time of systematic techniques for making and doing things, the term technology, a combination of the Greek techne, art, craft, with logos, word, speech, meant in Greece, discourse on the arts, both fine and applied. When it first appeared in English in the 17th century, it was used to mean a discussion of the applied arts only, and gradually these arts themselves came to the object of the designation. By the early 20th century, the term embraced a growing range of means, processes, and ideas in addition to tools and machines. But mid-century technology was defined by such phrases as a means of activity by which man seeks to change or manipulate his environment. Even such broad definitions have been criticized by observers who point out the increasing difficulty of distinguishing between scientific inquiry and technological activity. A highly compressed account of the history of technology, such as this one, must adopt a rigorous methodological pattern if it is to do justice to the subject without grossly distorting its one way or another. The plan followed in the present article is primarily chronological, tracing the development of technology through phases that succeed each other in time. Obviously, the division between phases is to a large extent arbitrary. One factor in the weighing has been the enormous acceleration of Western technological development in recent centuries. Eastern technology is considered in this article in the main only as it relates to development of modern technology. Within each chronological phase, a standard method has been adopted for surveying the technological experience and innovations. This begins with a brief review of the general social conditions of the period under discussion and then goes on to consider the dominant materials and sources of power of the period and their application to food production, manufacturing, industry, building, construction, transport and communications, military technology, and medical technology. In a final section, the socio-cultural consequences of technological change in this period are examined. This framework is modified according to particular requirements of every period. Discussions of new material, for instances, occupy a substantial place in the accounts of earlier phases when new metals were being introduced, but are comparatively unimportant in description of some of the later phases. But the general pattern is retained throughout. One key factor that does not fit easily into this pattern is that of development of tools. It has seemed most convenient to relate these to the study of materials rather to any particular application, but it has not been possible to be completely consistent in the treatment. Further discussion of specific areas of technological development is provided in a variety of other articles. The genius of Edison. Look around. Do you see electric lights or appliances plugged into electric sockets? Have you listened to music or seen a movie lately? Many of the things we now take for granted are thanks to the inventions of Thomas Alva Edison. Edison had patents on 1,093 inventions, including the phonograph, the incandescent light bulb, the movie camera, and an entire system of bringing electricity into our homes. This book describes a few of his most important inventions. Edison aimed to invent things that people would use. He researched his ideas and experimented, usually for many years, until his inventions were ready to manufacture and sell. Often, he and other inventors improved on each other's work. Edison considered himself an inventor and a businessman. He was full of ideas, but he was also a hard worker. He's a genius is 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration. Thomas Edison was born in 1847 in the small town of Milan, Ohio. When he was growing up, steam power was considered modern technology. Electricity was a mystery, and the practical uses for it were just starting to be explored. Since ancient times, people had been aware of the existence of electricity. However, it was not until 1820 that Danish scientist Hans Christian Ørsted discovered that an electric current could make a magnetized needle move. Now, scientists realized that electricity could be used to power machines. British scientist Michael Faraday advanced this research, and his work would later influence a young Thomas Edison. To Edison, electricity was a practical, efficient source of power for many of his inventions. He imagined that his inventions would change the world, and he worked to make his vision a reality. 1855, 8-year-old Thomas Alva Edison raised his hand. "Sir, may I ask you a question?" "You ask too many questions," Edison bellowed the schoolmaster. "But sir, quiet, Al, you'll get in trouble," whispered the boy next to him. It was too late. "What an addled boy you are," Edison shouted the schoolmaster. Edison knew that addled meant confused and stupid, and he was neither. He burst into tears and ran out of the schoolroom and all the way home to tell his mother. As a young child, Edison had been ill with scarlet fever, so he had only recently started school. But he kept fidgeting and asking questions which made the schoolmaster angry. When he told his mother, she insisted on seeing the schoolmaster. "Mrs. Edison," the schoolmaster sighed, "your son is a difficult boy." "Sir, Al has a very curious mind, but it is clear that he is not learning a great deal from you," she declared. "I was once a schoolmaster myself, and I shall now take over my son's education. Good day, sir." Edison's mother encouraged him to explore and learn on his own. He studied history, ancient myths, and the plays of Shakespeare. He didn't like math, but was fascinated by science. He experimented in a small laboratory at home. Edison was partially deaf, possibly due to the scarlet fever he had as a child. In later years, he said that being hard of hearing helped him concentrate because he wasn't distracted by the noise around him. At age 12, Edison sold newspapers and snacks on the steam trains between Port Huron, Michigan, and the city of Detroit. News reports from other states were sent via telegraph wires to offices at the main railway stations. Eventually, Edison published his own newspaper using these reports and sold it on the train. In his spare time on the train, he read scientific books and did experiments in a small laboratory that's set up in the baggage car. One day, Edison accidentally started a fire in the car. No one was hurt, but the angry conductor threw him off the train. One day, Edison saw a small boy playing on the train track right in the path of an approaching freight car. "Look out," he shouted. He dashed across the track, scooped the boy up, and quickly carried him to safety. The boy was the son of the station master. As a reward for saving his son's life, the station master taught Edison to send and receive telegraph messages in Morse code, the system of dots and dashes used in telegraphy. Soon, Edison became an expert telegrapher. At age 16, he began traveling around Canada and the U.S. working as a telegrapher in different cities. Edison also invented ways to improve the telegraph. The Morse repeater, for example, recorded the dots and dashes so they could be repeated later at a slower speed. This helped telegraphers decode long messages more accurately. However, his employer, Western Union, thought decoding messages with the Morse repeater was too slow. In 1868, Edison moved between cities and jobs. He was fired several times because the telegraph companies wanted operators, not experimenters. At age 21, he became a full-time inventor. He received his first patent in 1869 for the electric vote recorder. A friend tried to sell it to the U.S. Congress in Washington, D.C., but they said, "If there's any invention on the earth that we don't need, this is it." They liked voting slowly in case they wanted to change their minds. Disappointed, Edison decided that he would only invent what the public wants. He thought it was pointless inventing something that didn't sell. Later that year, Edison moved to New York City. He became interested in the New York Stock Exchange, where inventors bought and sold company shares. Edison used telegraph technology to improve the stock ticker, a machine that transmitted the constantly changing share prices. Edison sold the patent for his improved stock ticker and some related inventions to Western Union for $40,000. In 1871, with the money, Edison set up his own factory to make stock printers and a laboratory where he continued to work on the telegraph. On Christmas Day, he married Mary Stillwell, one of his employees. They had three children, Marion, Thomas Jr., and William. Although he nicknamed Marion and Thomas Jr. Dot and Dash after the Morse code signals, Edison didn't spend much time with his family. He was usually in the laboratory and often even fell asleep there. Edison invented the quadruplex telegraph in 1874. It could send and receive four messages at the same time, twice as many as previous machines. In 1875, he invented the electric pen. It had a small, motorized needle attached to make a stencil of the document being written. The document could then be copied using an ink press. During some experiments, Edison noticed mysterious sparks which suggested electricity could travel without wires. He called this phenomenon etheric force. Other scientists later used his observation as a basis for their investigation of radio waves. The invention factory. 1876. Profits from the factory paid for Edison's experiments, but running it distracted him from inventing. He wrote, "I have innumerable machines in my mind now which I shall continue to illustrate and describe." Throughout his life, he kept careful notes and drawings of his ideas. Edison built a bigger laboratory in New Jersey countryside at Menlo Park. He hired staff to manage his factory and accountants to manage the money, leaving him free to invent. Edison boasted that he and his highly skilled engineering team at Menlo Park would have a minor invention every 10 days and a big thing every 6 months or so. In the first 2 years, they received 32 patents for their inventions. Edison's first task was to improve the telephone that Alexander Graham Bell had invented earlier that year. Bell's telephone sent people voices down the wires, but it only worked across short distances. Edison used carbon particles, very finely powdered black soot in the transmitter, to make the electrical current stronger. Voices now came through the wires, loud and clear, even across long distances. 1877. While experimenting with a new machine to record telegraph signals, Edison heard an unexpected sound as he pulled strips of paper rapidly under a needle. Based on this, he began to envision a machine that could record voices. He set about designing a new device that would be able to store up and reproduce automatically at any future time the human voice perfectly. One December evening, Edison's staff gathered to watch a test. His new phonograph recorded onto a metal cylinder wrapped in tin foil. His staff doubted that a machine could record the human voice. Even Edison himself was secretly unsure. He sang the nursery rhyme, "Mary Had a Little Lamb," into the machine. Everyone was quiet as he turned the crank to play it back. Suddenly, they heard, "Mary had a..." It was Edison's voice coming from the phonograph. The day after the successful demonstration of the lab, Edison recorded a message on the phonograph. He then took it to the offices of Scientific American, an important magazine for scientists. Edison set up the phonograph on the editor's desk as curious employees gathered around. When he turned the crank, the phonograph spoke. It asked the astonished magazine editors if they're all impressed by Edison's new invention. They were. In January 1878, Edison demonstrated an improved version of the phonograph in New York City. The public was amazed. More demonstrations took place all over America and Great Britain during the following months. Some people even fainted on hearing Edison's speaking phonograph. At the age of 31, Edison became known as a wizard of Menlo Park. Edison originally intended the phonograph to be used in businesses to dictate letters or as an early telephone answering machine, but he discovered that the success of the phonograph came largely from its use in traveling shows, which are a popular form of entertainment. In April 1878, President Rutherford B. Hayes invited Edison to demonstrate the phonograph at the White House. Hayes was so delighted when he heard his own voice played back that he woke his sleeping wife so she could have a turn, too.
switching on the light.
In 1878, during a trip to see the eclipse of the sun, Edison and a friend discussed using electric current to make artificial light. Edison was so inspired, he later said, "The electric light idea took possession of me." Two main types of artificial light were already in use. Gas lamps were often unreliable and dangerous. Arc lights lit by an electric spark were suitable for street lamps, but far too bright for use in the home. Edison's alternative was an incandescent light bulb that glowed from the heat of an electric current. He was confident that he could succeed where others had failed. Edison announced to the press that he would invent not only a practical, long-lasting incandescent light bulb, but also a complete system of electrical lighting for everyday use, with a supply network to bring electricity from the generator into people's homes. He would also have to design equipment such as wires, circuits, switches, and sockets. Undaunted by the work ahead, Edison envisioned a world lit up. You've been listening to All Things History, a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program, schedule either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. This is Shruti, and...
This is Bird Note. I'm Brianna Amingwa, a birder, environmental educator, and mom of two little bird-loving boys.
I see a bird right there. Right.
You're right. I see him too. What's he doing?
I see what he's doing.
I've heard people say that little kids and birding do not mix. But as a parent and educator, I've seen how watching birds can teach kids to observe closely, to stretch their attention span, and to build empathy for the natural world.
I love the blue jays because they're my favorite color. They're my favorite birds in the whole city.
Nice. And what do blue jays look like when you see them? Like, how do you know that's a blue jay when you see it?
Because it's a jay and it's blue.
My kids remind me to appreciate the little things, like the birds right outside of our window. And when we bird together, we all get to practice the most important birding skill of all. Patience.
Waiting.
Mm-hmm. Watching
it's
birds
all
is...
about waiting.
It is. This is Black Birders Week. To learn how to participate, follow the hashtag Black Birders Week on social media and visit birdnote.org. I'm Brianna Amingwa. Thank you.
Have you listened to one of Audio Journal's most popular shows, Talking Topics, with host Bill Ruggiero? You can catch it on the second weekend of each month, airing Saturday at 3 p.m. and again on Sunday at 6 p.m. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.